You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome back to the Pod of Greed.
Welcome back indeed, folks.
Sorry for yelling. I don't know why I did that.
Today, we're doing Emptying the Pot. Woo!
We have all the questions, or at least a selection of the questions, because honestly, you guys leave. It's already too many questions. But we have a selection of questions that we are going to go through today. Because you want to hear our thoughts on some things, and we want to give them. That's our bread and butter. We like to yap about things.
A lot of Yu-Gi-Oh! Questions today. And actually, it's interesting, because you know, what I've kind of been trying to do lately is I've been mostly cutting the viewer questions from the end of each podcast and kind of just deciding, like, maybe have them all in this instead. Mm-hmm. You guys can let us know which method you prefer more. Do you like kind of having, like, one or two viewer questions at the end of each? Or do you like these more, this separated thing where it's just like a lot of Yu-Gi-Oh! Topics? We'd love to hear about it. Also, hype the video.
Yeah, guys, I don't know if you know about hyping, but you can like videos, you can subscribe to the channel, but you can also hype the video. It's only on mobile, but for small channels like ours, it goes a long way in helping us get surfaced.
Yeah, it spreads the video around, and of course, if you're listening in the premiere, one's in chat. Okay, so I guess we'll just take turns with these questions and see where it takes
us. Let me start us off, because that next one looks long.
Okay, you can start. Go ahead.
Regarding discourse around the Charmies and Turn Zero plays, a lot of the frustration surrounding them currently is because most decks were not designed with them in mind. Ideally, going forward, Konami designs decks that have better Charmy lines and either Turn Zero plays themselves or ways to counter Turn Zero plays. Do you think Konami will consistently design decks this way moving forward, or do you think this will be a sporadic thing relegated to only select archetypes?
Oh, this is a good one. Okay, so there has been a lot of discourse in the last few months, really, about the idea of Turn Zero in Yu-Gi-Oh! For anybody who's listening and kind of doesn't know exactly what that term means, it's basically the idea that a lot of decks that have come out now, at least the stronger decks, have the ability to start playing their engine cards even during the opponent's first turn. So some examples of that would be maybe like Draco Tail Fymina, where she can just pitch during either main phase to start Fusion Summoning.
Yep.
And so in theory, even if my opponent was taking their first turn, I could use Fymina to like start fusing, and you know, as the Draco Tail effects go, it'll start sort of setting stuff up for my next turn before my first turn. And different decks have this to different degrees. K9s have Azuna, Vanquisol has Holly Sue, Tier Limits had Havness. And a few more decks have been getting cards kind of like this that let them play in this way. But the concern that some people have about this design philosophy is that while it does have some benefits, those benefits being like that it sort of helps to subvert going second. Like normally in Yu-Gi-Oh! Going second sucks. Going first is really good. You feel hopeless and like you have to sit and watch a cutscene. Well, now you can kind of get to playing in advance on your opponent's turn.
Right.
And that's always nice. And it kind of even undermines a bit of the power of a hand traps that are sometimes seen as very like silver bullet, floodgate hand traps like Drone Lockbird or, you know, whatever, Artifact Lancia. Sometimes this can subvert those a little bit, even the Multicharmy cards to a degree. But the downside that people have with it is that it is, A, just a type of power creep in general,
right,
where some newer decks have access to it, and it speeds the game up even more. And also that, yeah, older decks can't do it. So there's just not a way for most decks released before like 2024, 2025, if they were even lucky enough, you know, because not even all the decks released last year have this, but like if your archetype wasn't lucky enough to have a turn zero card, then you feel especially left in the dust. Particularly,
I just gotta run my stupid hand traps.
Yeah, particularly if you're running like a deck that is a trap based deck in general, where traps are already slow. And going second, you know, suck, you set your traps first.
Nobody has to wait anymore to set a trap. Nowadays, if a deck sets a trap, it can activate at the same turn.
Yeah, so, this, you know, that's kind of the conversation with it. What do you think, Alec, of these turn zero plays? As somebody who's played, you've played Draco Tale, I know.
Yeah.
So you have some experience with this. How do you feel about this? And do you think Konami is going to like design a lot of decks like this? Only some?
I mean, if you look at history, Konami typically, you know, once they have a new type of card design, they push it, they push it, they push it until they make it bad. So I think if you was looking at the past, I think Konami, of course, makes more turn zero cards because turn zero, being able to play on your opponent's very first turn is a sign of strength for an archetype. It's what can separate a top tier archetype from a rogue archetype.
Yeah.
But Paul and I were talking off camera before we pod, which is a waste of our time.
Yeah, it kind
of
is.
But we were talking about how Chaos Origin cards seem to be designed. And I don't see too much turn zero potential in the new archetypes that are being revealed. And yeah, so I'm wondering
so far.
Like, I'm wondering if Konami might be trying to draw a line with card design now.
Yeah.
But can new archetypes even compete if they don't have turn zero plays? Because, I mean, we have so much disgusting mess in this game.
Yeah, they do. So as turn zero goes, everything I said up to now is just like a synopsis of the situation.
He hadn't given an opinion.
So now, for my actual opinion on the cards, I think they're really fun to use in like a tournament setting. I think for me, like when I'm playing in a tournament, there's so much anxiety around like your own performance and, you know, preparedness and all these things. And so having a way to play when you go second is a source of like relief almost. That, you know, the dice roll or whatever wasn't the arbiter of fate. We're like, oh, I lost the dice roll. I'm going to just lose this round because they're going to go first and, you know, whatever. So I tend to like the turn zero cards. I think that as long as they are not disruptive to the opponent, which they can be, but I think that when they're not disruptive to the opponent, I don't have too much of a problem with them. I know Famina is really strong, but I tend to find her to be like not too bad.
Look, I don't know.
But like, I don't know. Like sometimes it's just, it does suck when, but like I say that as somebody who like, I'm oftentimes playing a deck myself that has access to them. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, right now I'm playing Radiant Typhoon. They've got like Croce. But even when I use Rescue Ace, even Rescue Ace has like some turn zero cards with like Rescue Ace Impulse. I think that for decks that don't have access to it, you feel very, very far behind. Like you feel like, you know, you are committing to the board and like, you know, you're having to like wait your turn so much and these other decks just aren't.
I don't know, like, so I played a bit of Draco Tale and Faimana just stresses me out. Like, because I'm an older style Yu-Gi-Oh player, a lot of the trends in the metagame, they hit me all at once because I'll take time off from playing. And so playing Draco Tale, all of a sudden I'm playing a deck that has a turn zero play in Faimana, and I'd never dealt with that before. And honestly, that stressed me the hell out. My first few times playing Draco Tale, I didn't want to see Faimana in my hand because I didn't know how to actually use a turn zero card. Yes, I can activate it on my opponent's first turn, but I didn't know like what was the best way to do it. Am I trying to set up for my actual first turn? Am I trying to disrupt their play? Am I going to accidentally turn something on for my opponent by having like a monster on board when normally I wouldn't?
Yeah, and there's like a bit of a learning curve with them, I agree. Like, I remember, I think like they feel like they've been integrated pretty well now, but yeah, early on it was pretty easy to like see a turn zero card but not necessarily like make the best use of it. Like, I think now people have realized, like, say with Faimana for instance, you know, you wait until the very end of your opponent's main phase and then you use it as like a just way to, let's say, use Urgula or Pan to pop cards that they have in the field at a time where they have no way to recover those cards, right? Like, you know, like what is it, Urgula can pop spells and traps. Mm-hmm. And Pan can pop monsters. And so, like,
I've always thought that's weird because the colors of the monsters are reversed to what you think they'd hit.
And so, like, basically, if, you know, I'm going first, I'm playing, like, a regular deck. It doesn't have, like, turn zero stuff. It's a kind of regular deck.
Dark Magician.
I set up, I have to set a couple cards, and then Urgula and Pan pop up at the end of my main phase. and they start popping stuff that I've already set, even maybe Called by the Grave, which would normally stop 5 mana, I have to like either hold Called by the Grave and assume you have 5 mana, or set it, and now it can't stop 5 mana because it can't be flipped, and then it even gets popped, and it's just like a whole... That situations like that, I think, are where people really get annoyed with these cards. Same with Izuna and Lupus, where, you know, you use a card effect in your hand, just kind of in this, as a natural part of your combo, and now you are being punished for it on your own turn. It can feel really... It's weird. I guess to answer the actual question is, do you think this is going to be like a normal thing, or is it going to be a sporadic thing? I hope it's normal if this is what Konami wants tournaments to look like. I think that every deck should get cards like it. I've seen that they have kind of retroactively gone back and given some archetypes turn zero things. Like, I play Dogmatica. It's very, you know, bad tier 17 deck or whatever. But, like, even they got Fleur-de-Lis the Lightning, which is a selective turn zero card that they can use. And so, like, if they're willing to go back and give older archetypes access to these sorts of things, that's good. I don't know if they will. I hate to give this the lazy answer, but it really just remains to be seen. Like, it might happen, and it just might not.
My only issue with turn zero cards in play is just that I think it puts card design in an awkward spot, because it's hard to make something better than a play that you can make on your opponent's very first turn.
So you don't maybe care for the power creep it introduces?
Yeah, because I just get a little scared, because I'm like, well, what are you going to make to beat that?
Yeah, what becomes like the counterplay to a turn zero thing? And as it is, there's like rarely any, like very rarely is there much you can do about Holly Sue, for instance. So, yeah, you know, now that I think about it, while it is nice to be in the in-group, like, you know, you're playing one of these decks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're in the out-group, it is kind of, yeah, you're right, it's rough. I also, one last thing that was mentioned in this question is, like, the Molcharmy lines and stuff, like, giving decks better ways to deal with those Molcharmy cards. I have my own set of thoughts about the Molcharmys, so I won't get into all of it here, but I, in a general sense, I almost kind of don't like when Konami gives decks so many ways around what cards that were supposed to be answers. Agreed. So it's like, you know, we made these Charmies to kind of answer a common problem in Yu-Gi-Oh, which is excess summoning, or we made, you know, Drawn Lockbird is supposed to kind of counter this, or even in the case of, like, let's say Dark Ruler No More, or some other, like, board-breaking type of card, where they'll make it, and clearly, like, it's meant to rein things in. Nibiru is another card that fits under this. But then as time goes on, Konami designs these decks that, like, play around Droll, play around Nib, play around Ash, play around, like, all this stuff. And so it's like, well, it's, as a player, again, it feels cool. Like, I played around on my opponent's hand traps. But then it's like, man, like, how, you know, how far does this go before it feels like it's just breaking?
I don't know. You know, it puts us in that power creep cycle of just, we make this to beat that, we make that to beat this, and... You know, maybe some things you don't have to be able to beat. Maybe sometimes your opponent picks up the right card at the right time and they win.
Yeah. So that's, I guess, our answer to it. I hope we gave at least some things to think about. Okay, I guess I'll read the next one because it's long. Hey, Pod. I've been having an ongoing argument with a friend for a bit over a year now and would love your opinions on the matter. I argue that competitive level Magic is easier to learn and get into as a hobby than competitive level Yu-Gi-Oh! Is. Between timing restrictions and chain blocks, along with all the text on cards, increasingly a problem for Magic 2, I think it's harder to get into at a higher level. So this person said, like, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is harder to get into. He argues otherwise, talking about resource management with lands and learning the different keywords and how they interact. Which do you think is harder to get into? P.S. Not to rag on my friend too hard, but I think his argument is in a bit of bad faith, considering he considers any kind of summoning past fusions to be stupid and refuses to play with them. Ah! Well, that does reframe the argument a little.
That certainly changes my opinion of the person I haven't met. But, I mean, I guess at the premise this by saying, well, neither of us have played or intend to play competitive Magic the Gathering. So
our answers are going to be limited.
Yeah. Now, we will gladly give them. So, you know, we're going to give our opinions anyway. That's why you're here. Mm-hmm. As far as competitive Magic versus competitive Yu-Gi-Oh, I don't think it's a stretch to say that competitive Yu-Gi-Oh! Is more of a complex game than, or more complex to get into than competitive Magic. I'm not saying that Yu-Gi-Oh! is like harder to play than Magic, or Magic's harder to play than Yu-Gi-Oh! I'm just saying that I think up front, Yu-Gi-Oh! Asks a lot of you to get into the competitive sphere of it. Because literally from turn one, as we just finished on our last question, you have to be able to like dive deep into the waters of Yu-Gi-Oh! With your opponent from the moment you start your draw phase. In Magic, because it's a slower game than Yu-Gi-Oh!, you know, you're not going to play your first land and immediately have to like go into time trying to figure out how to like resolve some crazy chain. But in Yu-Gi-Oh!, we don't take that many turns per game.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that in my experience and my like limited, you know, observation and understanding, I think that Yu-Gi-Oh! Is the more demanding game to like get into and play. I want to be careful to clear something up though. That does not mean better in any way. Right. I think when people hear like Yu-Gi-Oh! Is a harder game than Magic, I think that they hear that and they kind of read it as like the person saying that like Yu-Gi-Oh! Is kind of a more prestigious game to be good at than Magic, or if you're good at Yu-Gi-Oh! It means that like you're a smarter person or like better at card games in general, all these things. Like, or that Yu-Gi-Oh! I'm not saying any of that. All I'm saying is that I think that Yu-Gi-Oh! Is very demanding. That has pros, it has cons, that's for certain people, and it's not for others. And like, I don't think it's just like it's this objective like harder equals better game. I think that it just, Yu-Gi-Oh! When I play it, and when I play competitively, you know, I've been doing the regional circuit and stuff, I'm reminded constantly that this game is brutal. It's really unforgiving, it moves really fast, and the amount of, like, attentiveness that you must have at all times, from the word go, like, you know, even from the prep and all that stuff, but just from the word go is, like, so, for instance, right now I'm playing Radiant Typhoon. And, like, literally from the draw phase, I'm having to, like, stop and, like, think about, like, chain orders and activation stuff and just all these little things and, like, timings. And I think the mental stack of stuff that you have to contend with at once, like, more early in the game, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is, like, it's really laying them on you. Like, there's a lot.
I think once you get up to speed, like, once a Magic game ramps up and it matches the speed of a Yu-Gi-Oh! Game, I actually don't think Magic and Yu-Gi-Oh! Are very different as far as what would be asked of you in a competitive match of Magic the Gathering or Yu-Gi-Oh! A chain and the stack, they are not very different concepts. And to do well in either game, you have to have mastered both those concepts. And what I think you notice a lot with competitive card gamers, especially like champions, you notice a lot of like the very best card gamers can usually move between multiple card games, because I honestly think the skill set it requires to be like truly a professional card gamer is actually pretty samey across card games.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's a certain amount of just transferability, and I would even go as far as to say that like these games are testing some of the same skill sets and some different ones. Like, there are certain things that, like, you know, Yu-Gi-Oh! Just asks of you that Magic doesn't, and I'm certain that there are things in Magic that, like, you have to think about. It sounds like, you know, like, resource management looks different in Magic than it does in Yu-Gi-Oh! Mm-hmm. Like, Yu-Gi-Oh!'s modern resource management isn't what it was, like, you know, 20 years ago.
Hell, it's not even what it was, like 3 years ago.
Yeah, it's constantly
changing. Now time is the resource.
Yeah, time's a whole thing. Hard once per turns kind of have taken on a new identity. The way that card economy works is, like, it's kind of diminished in a way. There's so many little things, and I could go on and on and on, but, like, what I will say is that I don't think that there's a, like, harder or... I don't think, like, harder is a binary thing. Like, it's just objectively harder to play Yu-Gi-Oh! But from my experience, Yu-Gi-Oh! Certainly feels more like it is just demanding to start playing and, like kind of get in the door with competing. It seems like it is asking more of you, but I don't think that, like, it says that you are, like, a better card gamer all around or something. Just that it's just asking more.
Now, I will say that Yu-Gi-Oh! Does have this kind of uniqueness to the card game where you don't necessarily have to learn how to play Yu-Gi-Oh! To play Yu-Gi-Oh! You have to learn a deck, right?
Yeah, that's true. Like, that's a great point.
Because in a lot of cases, our decks play so differently from one another that learning to play Radiant Typhoons and learning to play, let's say I'm on Pumpkin right now. Learning to play those two decks doesn't actually benefit me if I'm only intending to play Pumpkin. It might make me better in my Radiant Typhoon matchup, but
yeah,
it's better to actually focus, right?
Decks in Yu-Gi-Oh! Are so different. Like, you know, each deck kind of has its own, like, very unique gimmick and thing. And so I do find that, comparatively, I think that in Magic, having a fundamental knowledge of Magic seems to transfer over from deck to deck more readily. I'm picking my words carefully here. More readily than it does in Yu-Gi-Oh!
But we also don't play competitive Magic. It might not be the case. Magic's very keyword heavy, and certain, like, color combinations have access to different keywords. And I know it can get, the rulings get deep with some of those keywords, so maybe it's the same, I don't know.
Yeah, last thing I will say is that if your friend has not played anything past Fusions, well, here's all I'll say about that, actually. You should encourage him to try them out. You know, there's nothing can form a better, like, opinion and scope of things than just playing them yourself. If he thinks that, like, Synchros and Xyz and Pendulums and Links and all that stuff, like, ruined Yu-Gi-Oh! And they're bad and evil and terrible or whatever, I disagree with that, but, like, he or she should play this stuff and try to, you know, approach it in earnest and see if their opinions on it change. I know that's, like, asking a lot. If he's already kind of, like, dug his heels in, like, you know, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is just not the game for him, that's fine. But if you want to have a good discussion about these things, it would behoove this friend to try those out so that you guys can probably have a more fruitful discussion about it.
I mean, I didn't get into Synchros until I started watching Yu-Gi-Oh! 5Ds because Synchros came out at a time I wasn't playing as much Yu-Gi-Oh! I was getting a little bit older now. And so I kind of was like, oh, they made these white cards. I guess it looks cool or whatever, but I'm not really checking for that. But then, like, you know, my brother started putting on 5Ds in the mornings on Saturdays. I started watching, and I was like, yeah, this Yusei guy, he's kind of cool. Stardust Dragon, oh, man. Next thing you know, I want to play Synchros when I was very indifferent about them before. So maybe have them watch the anime.
Yeah, familiarity, I think, like, plays in so much. Like, people will kind of dislike these new mechanics just because it didn't come at a time for them when, like, they were maybe still because what usually happens is, like, oh, I just stopped watching Yu-Gi-Oh! At that time, so now I'm going to just say Xyz ruined things, or I say Lynx ruined things, but, you know. Anyway, yeah, it's a good question.
And they have a story about how, like, a Synchro monster, like, made them lose a tournament and it burned down their house. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, it
took all your money.
I guess you should hate them.
Something, something, house arrest, gas leak, whatever.
All right, next question. I've accepted that I'm just a casual player. Right on. I always said that I don't mind losing a game, even in a competitive setting, but I stopped going to locals because the competitive players are very rude and insulting. They sucked all the fun out of the experience. Your thoughts? All right. I will say, I feel like we got one side of the argument here. So yeah. I struggle a little to give my thoughts.
Yeah, I would love to know, in all seriousness, you know, what necessarily, like, rude and insulting kind of means in this context. And I'm not just trying to play devil's advocate. I really am being serious because, like, I have been to so many card shops in my day. Like, I've really been to a lot of different shops. I've kind of seen what the culture and stuff is like. And you see this core conflict of, like, kind of a casual player, a competitive player, or at least, you know, that's maybe how they would self-identify. Mm-hmm. Butting heads and kind of both walking away from the experience, feeling hard done by, feeling like the other side has just misrepresented them, doesn't get it. So I don't know, like, what these disagreements or conflicts look like for you, but what I will say is this, just I'm going to take the question at face value. Usually people who are competitive types, who are also kind of, they can get nasty and, like, rude and insulting, the silver lining I can say about that is usually the truth is they're actually probably like not as good as they think they are. Mm-hmm. Like that's kind of what I noticed. I think that the competitive players who are really good at this game, like actually really good, don't have much to say about anyone else. And I think that comes from a realization that like we said in the last question, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is really hard. Yu-Gi-Oh! Is really deep. Yu-Gi-Oh! Is really challenging. And Yu-Gi-Oh! Is, you know, to be good at it takes so much work and such an open mind and even such a like acceptance of ego death to some degree that if you are still like at your locals saying like someone's a scrub for playing a deck they like or like you're casual and you don't have good cards or whatever, you're probably maybe at best like a big fish in a small pond. Like maybe you're the guy who like you can win at your locals because you've got a pretty good deck and like you know a little more than other people at your shop do. Mm-hmm. But if there's one thing I've learned, you take these people out of their small, like kind of local 12-person tournament and like throw them into the deep end and they just end up kind of in the middle. There's another person at the regional who goes like 4-4 and they're, you know, still just complaining about like, I got slow played, whatever happened, the Drolls and the Charmies beat me. And like, so those types kind of tend to be that way.
You know, I don't care for the like competitive label. Mm-hmm. It's similar to the casual label where I think a lot of people misuse it. But I think there's a lot of people who say they're competitive, but they're not. And there are people who we think are competitive, but they're not. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of funny. Are you competitive just because you try hard? Are you competitive just because you want to win? Like, a lot of people want to try hard and want to win, and they can't get into the NBA. I feel like just yelling a lot and playing fast and being aggressive at the table doesn't mean you're a competitive player. This means you're a rude player who's actually kind of bad.
Like, yeah, these terms are... That's something that I've been wrestling with myself, actually. Not yelling at my opponents. I haven't been doing that. But, you know, is wrestling with, like, these nebulous terms that are so all-encompassing that they also can just lose their meaning a little bit. Like,
it's weird because we, you know, at one point we made our bread and butter off those two terms
specifically. Yeah, like we've made like so many skits and like kind of these comparisons. And I sometimes look back and I'm like, you know, maybe we were like even part of the problem. We were contributing to this whole like this binary world of, you know, the competitive types are like always rude and they're mean and then that... and that's what it means to be a competitive player is to be a try-hard asshole. Like, I don't think that's true, but, like, we might have perpetuated that point of view. And also that casuals are kind of just these innocent victims who sort of, like, they just want to have fun and they're just trying to, like, play their favorite pet deck and, you know, they're just kind of here to hang out. But also, like, they're always at the receiving end of the mean, big, bad, competitive, I'm using air quotes here, player. And in reality, like, I don't know that that many players truly fit into either of these things. Like, I think that you will often find casual players who, you know, they have casual tendencies, we'll say. Like, you know, they might be playing more of, like, a pet deck or, you know, maybe they play on more of a budget, but they're also defensive about their card choices, or maybe they kind of get angry when they lose to, you know, the meta deck. And so if you're upset about losing, then I guess you had some competitive fire in you. So like, are you fully competitive in that way? Well, you're some of it.
Kinda, I guess.
Some of it.
But I mean, it's weird. So the most rude person I've ever played a card game with is what could never be labeled competitive. They didn't use new cards. Their decks oftentimes just stalled out and just wasted everyone's time. So I get you would call them casual just by virtue of the kind of cards that they use, but those were like it was a casual person who's the rudest player I've ever played with.
Yeah.
I have played with like more like rude tryhards before, but the worst one I've ever played with would be considered casual. And, you know, we've been around a couple world tournaments. We've been around some top players before. And I would call those people the most competitive people I've ever met. And for the most part,
they tend to be pretty chill.
I have seen a mental breakdown, but that wasn't like they weren't yelling at their opponent. They were mostly stressed about their own rounds. Yeah.
So that's interesting. There's almost like a hierarchy of kind of how the competitive spectrum and like the personality spectrum and how they kind of play out. I'm generalizing, but I think that this is sort of how I viewed it.
I think it was like an inversion to it.
Something like that. So basically, like, at the top level, you have like pretty high level players who are very good at the game, and they're actually usually pretty chill. Like, their antsiness comes mostly from like a pressure on themselves to perform well and like do the right thing. But often they're not like really antagonistic to their opponents, more that they're just on eggshells in general about making sure that like everything kind of plays out as it should and that they're getting the results that they feel that they have put a lot of work into. So they can come across maybe as like a little bit prickly, but it's not like they're not making it a point to talk about people. Generally, they're pretty calm and chill about that. Case in point, talk to Jesse Cotton, right? He's a great example of this. And there's plenty of others. Like, they're agreeable people. Right beneath those kind of competitive people is where things can get a little bit nastier, where it's like the sort of, I don't want to call them just the wannabe competitive type. The almost was there. They are clearly better than most of the people at their shop. They've put in the money to get the best decks, and they are trying to hit that next level, but like they kind of haven't hit that humility point. They haven't hit the, what I almost call it, you know, the ego death, where they still, you know, they're copying the best people, but it's like a trickle-down of it. So there's still some insecurity there. There's still some kind of an excuse-making thing where, like, I only lost you because of a fluke, or it's bullshit, you're playing a gimmick, right? Like, you'll even hear them say, I've heard this, is like, you don't deserve to have won because, like, you misplayed, and, like, even though you beat me, like, you didn't play this right. Like, all of those types of insults tend to come from, like, that crowd of person who's not actually at or even very near the top, but yeah.
Like, it's like that they feel like they could have been.
They could have been, or they're almost there, or whatever. Then there's some vague middle ground. Then you get into like the casual, the two brands of casuals. There's casuals who are like chill. They really are just here to play. They don't mind losing. They will say know their place, whatever that means. And it's fine, it's okay. Then there's like the kind of the bitter casual. The casual who
they're angry.
You know, they're kind of angry. Like they see these meta, like these are the meta sheep. They're the tryhards. They're all like playing the best deck. And if they just weren't playing that, then I wouldn't have won. I don't like what this game's come to, and everything past synchro is bad. And like it kind of spirals into these attacks on what the game has become, what like my opponents are doing that is not allowing my pet deck to win, not allowing my old deck to win. And like you were saying, those people can be just as nasty. Yeah. They have the capacity to be just as nasty, just as critical of their opponents, and like just as unpleasant to sit across the table from. Sometimes those are like people playing like the Fossil Dyna stun deck. And they're still like bitter and mean to you. Like,
you've locked up all my cards. I can't play anything. Why are you angry? I played out of it.
Yeah, they're angry. Like, I mean, I've faced that person that, you know, they are playing Fossil Dyna Stun. They're mad that you outed Fossil Dyna Stun and, like, you know, whatever. So it exists on both, but it's kind of interesting because, like, I've talked a lot about this, so I'll try to wrap it up. But, like, I guess I'll just say this. True casuals are chill. True competitive types are chill. It's, like, wannabe.
Those middle people.
It's those weird wannabe people who aren't being honest.
They haven't accepted who they really are.
Yeah, that's how I see it anyway. I hope that in your case, to get back to your question, you know, I hope that maybe like you can try to go to locals again and reason with these people, see if anything's changed. You know, I'm not really sure what the altercation looked like, so I can't speak much to it, but
I don't even know what your like geographic area is like. I'd say try a different local if that's even a feasible thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so, all right, I guess my next question. Why don't you think Konami use card subtypes and symbols anymore? Examples, continuous, counter, equip, etc. Do you think there's still room to innovate in this space, like a fusion subtype of spell, similar to ritual? I did always wonder that myself. Or a hand subtype for traps, which can be activated from the hand. Or set on the field for stronger effects, similar to Imperm. This is a fun one.
I have I've actually thought about this before, and I have a theory.
I have one too. I'm interested if we have the same theory, because we haven't talked about this.
That's true. We have not. I think this goes back to the late, great Kazuki Takahashi.
Okay.
I think the symbols in this game were designed by him for Yu-Gi-Oh! For the cards, and at some point, like, Konami and the powers that be said that's all there will be. This was his game. These were his symbols. We're not going to add any more to it.
Right.
I have nothing to base that off of, but that's just been my theory on it.
So what I think too, I think that's probably, I think that's pretty serviceable. What I would add is that I think that the subtypes, like let's say Union, Spirit, Gemini, we've actually made videos about those, and you sometimes will notice that like Konami will make cards that function a lot like Spirits but aren't called Spirits. And we've seen a lot of cards that function like Unions but just aren't, they don't have the Union designation.
Yep.
And, you know, even as a kid, I always wondered, like, why are there ritual spells but not fusion spells? Like, why isn't there, like, a symbol for a fusion spell? Like how there's a symbol for a ritual spell. It's a good thought. I think that Konami finds those symbols and those subtypes to be limiting. Because once you make a symbol or a subtype and kind of have core mechanics that go with it, you are now, like, locked into designing card, like, you know, like what those cards can and can't do mechanically. When Konami,
oh, that's a good point.
I think when Konami makes cards these days, they make archetypes and stuff. Their archetypes do all kinds of stuff that sort of vaguely resembles old mechanics or whatever. This is gonna sound like kind of a mean way of putting it, but Konami kind of likes to be able to cheat. They like for cards to be able to cheat mechanics, to kind of like squeak around restrictions, and they want the freedom to fully explore that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like I noticed in this question, we talk about, well, what if there was like a fusion subtype of spell similar to ritual? And I agree, that'd be really cool. But Konami kind of wants the freedom to have a quick play spell that fuses.
So that's actually exactly what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we got a quick play fusion spell well before we ever had the ability to use a spell speed to ritual summon. Because, well, the problem was quick play had its own symbol and ritual had its own symbol, which inherently meant no ritual cards at the time could be at spell speed too. And until eventually they made quick play spells that let you ritual summon, but they're not ritual cards.
Yeah. And I think like that's the thing is, you know, Konami kind of wants to have the freedom of being like, okay, we can have a, like, so Secrets of Dark Magic, right?
That's what I was thinking.
You know,
it
can, it's a quick play fusion or ritual thing. And they want the freedom to kind of be able to like do that as much as they want. And there are plenty of other examples. You know, this question's kind of like sudden for me, but like I could think of a few others where I think that they just want to be able to, like, Infernoble Knights kind of can equip to stuff. But then also you've got like Snake Eyes that push monsters into the back row. But then also like you've got Millennium Monsters that can be treated as like continuous spell and traps in the back row. And even though it's like two different ways of getting into the same thing, they kind of have different purposes for how they work. And so I think Konami knows that they would be maybe limiting themselves if they said that there's just a symbol that encompasses all of it. Similar with the traps too, like I do think it'd be neat if there was a symbol that could be put on a trap that just designates that like this trap can be activated from hand. Like the example you gave was like Infinite Impermanence, or maybe you think of like Evenly Matched or the Dominus cards. But the truth is what Konami wants is to, this is getting into my second reason, which is related to the first, is that they want the freedom to balance it how they would like it to be balanced. So all those traps that can activate from your hand have different requirements to activate from your hand. You can only use Imperm from your hand if you control no other cards. You can only use Evenly Matched from your hand if you control no other cards with like the end of the battle phase. But then the Dominus cards don't actually have any of that. They just are like, you can use them from your hand no matter what. And they rather have like a restriction at the end of them where like, if you chose to use them from your hand, then you have this other restriction placed on you for the rest of the duel. And so if they were all just stuck under the, like, you can activate this from your hand symbol, then it might actually, like, restrict the way that they can design them.
Right.
Because you have to give Yu-Gi-Oh! A lot of credit for, like, it is a, for as much text as on these godforsaken cards, they are very, very finely worded so that, you know, like, even Infinite Impermanence has, like, super subtle nuances to it that, like, a lot of people don't really catch. Like, you know, the fact that, like, if you can get certain cards, like, out of a column or whatever, like, that it won't work certain ways. And, like, same with Evenly Matched. Like, if Evenly Matched leaves the field before it actually has its effect resolved, then you'll have, like, zero cards in your field and you have to banish everything. All these little tiny things. And so I think, like, Konami doesn't want that. And then a similar example to the Ritual Quick Play and Fusion Quick Play thing is, like, Red Reboot, which is a counter trap from the hand.
Yep.
And so it wouldn't be able to use another symbol, too. And, like, that's... So there's, like, a whole thing with that. Like, I think it, what it comes down to is that Konami kind of just wants the freedom to make cards be able to, like, kind of, like, weasel around restrictions and be free and not be limited by a symbol.
And honestly, when they were designing those symbols, the look at the game was very myopic. I don't think they envisioned a type of spell past Ritual.
I agree.
I think when they came up with it all, like, Ritual was supposed to be at its own type of spell to the same degree as Quick Play, Continuous. We're supposed to see, like, Rituals were just going to be a mainstay in the game. But the game has moved, like quite far beyond Rituals to now where we ask, like, well, why don't other things have a symbol? Because they were putting themselves into a box when they thought that Yu-Gi-Oh! would
be one thing, and it just...
Yeah, they thought Yu-Gi-Oh! Was going to be, like, a 10-year game, if that.
Yeah, and Yu-Gi-Oh! Today, it's like, you know, it truly is just a different game, and it is a game that actually, I have made this comparison before. I think Yu-Gi-Oh! Almost is like suffers from being called Yu-Gi-Oh! Because 2005 Yu-Gi-Oh! And, like, 2025 Yu-Gi-Oh! Two different games, they happen to share the same name, and it causes a lot of these uncomfortable conversations people have about, like, what Yu-Gi-Oh!'s become, what it ought to have been, when in reality, we're just talking about two different games.
Yeah.
And one is just kind of bound by a few of those early things you're describing. Those early, like, decisions that kind of had to be finalized, and we're stuck to them. So, okay. So yeah, that was my question.
Oh, this one's nice and short. What product do you think Logan Paul will scalp only to find out no one wants it?
Any Yu-Gi-Oh! Product at all.
I don't think it's that simple.
No, I'm kidding. There's a lot.
I think Yu-Gi-Oh! Is very scalpable. It just needs the right Paul brother to shine a light on it.
I saw recently that Logan Paul was saying, like, that he's going to be trying to get, like, a PSA 10 first ed blue eyes.
Shouldn't be that hard.
Going to be, like, opening some LOB box, you know.
He better watch out for the scammers.
Yeah, better.
Cause we know all about that, huh, Paul? I've
been scammed a little bit on a LOB box. That's all I can say about that.
But, I mean, there are plenty of, because in this space that we're in right now, new TCGs pop up, like, constantly. I'm sure there's quite a few TCGs out there that Logan Paul could try to get, like, his scalping culture into, and it just won't really amount to much. You know, he could always try and get into, what's that new one that's out again? Is that Neopets?
Yeah. It's, you know, there is a Neopets game that is interesting to think about in 2026. Not saying it's bad, just interesting to think about. I think, like, with the Paul brothers, specifically Logan, because, like, you know, he's been the one doing all this card game stuff. It's funny that there's, like, almost a fear of, like, him getting into your game. Like, the One Piece players hated when he got into it. Yu-Gi-Oh! Players are kind of wary that, like, he's expressed interest in that, especially at a time when the overframes are about to come out and all that stuff.
I have a buddy who's really into the Dragon Ball card game, and he always buys a case of every single Dragon Ball set. But this was the first time he actually complained about the price of the case.
Oh, has it gone up?
Because, well, scalpers have reached for Goku now, too.
Yeah, the scalpers really seem like they'll go for anything. I don't know what Logan Paul's next, like, target will be. It seems like maybe it'll be Yu-Gi-Oh! For a bit. I don't know. But there, for all of the bad that can do, there can be some good that can come of it. Like, Pokemon, we've described this many times. It's really easy to build a Pokemon deck because the scalpers who, you know, try to buy all this sealed product for every new thing, it can be tough if you're, like, a person who wants to go and buy an ETB maybe when it first comes out. But if you are just trying to like build a deck,
build and play
with singles and like play, so much stuff gets opened in Pokemon, and they have that already pretty generous printing structure.
It does help to drive down the price of their singles.
Yeah, the price of like just stray singles is driven so low. Like, as a player, there's very little to worry about, like, getting the cards and just playing them. There's something else I was going to add to that. I mean, but I do think, like, if Logan Paul tries to scalp Yu-Gi-Oh, I think that there's... I don't know, like, what you even scalp, like, in Yu-Gi-Oh today.
See,
like,
I don't think... Because it doesn't work the same way with Yu-Gi-Oh. Because if he were trying to get into Yu-Gi-Oh, he'd be digging into, like, LLB boxes. And the people who follow him would be digging into old Yu-Gi-Oh sets, where the singles for those sets aren't really desirable. They're not relevant
today. Like, for players, we won't be very affected by that.
Because, like, Logan Paul could discover, like, 7 cases of, like, first edition LLB, right? Crack them all. There's only a handful of cards in that box that will have a price on them, and they could dump all the other cards online, and they and just won't nothing. Sell.
Yeah.
It's not even a matter that they'll sell for a little. No, they just won't sell.
Yeah, it won't. The collector market, particularly the old school collector market and the modern day gaming like player market, are so vastly far apart from each other. Oh,
what monster were we trying to pull out of LLB? Do you remember?
No, what? We were trying to pull a monster?
Yeah, remember? Because we played Rare Hunters, and we wanted to have the best monster. Manator
Bug? I don't know.
Like, Manator Bug, Skull Red Bird.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. If those were what were... Those are like some of the desirable cards that were in LOB, and nobody's going to buy those.
I mean, I think that the... To answer the question, I think that the next game that Logan might, I guess, try to get his grubby mitts on, I'd guess either Gundam or perhaps...
I would be genuinely surprised if Logan Paul knows a damn thing about Gundam.
I mean, remember, he barely even knew anything about One Piece, though. Because there's a whole video of him saying, like,
I didn't see it.
Luffy D. Monkey or whatever, and people got...
That was upset. Probably on purpose.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, maybe it's Gundam just because I know that Bandai kind of tends to market Gundam as a more premium-ish game. Like, they have a lot of stuff on premium Bandai. But it does seem like with Logan, he goes for games that have more of a history, like a something that's been really long running. And while the Gundam IP is quite old, the game is so new that I don't think that there would be a perception of like, because he wants those old grails. He wants that old Pikachu. He wants that old blue
Gundam
eyes.
Gundam doesn't have that prestige.
So there's not like any, so I don't know that, that there's much left for him to really go after.
I agree. Maybe. I just don't think there's much room for Paul to grow.
That's right. Mom said I'll have a growth spurt next year. Okay. Would Yu-Gi-Oh work better if they had a rotation of sets like Magic? I feel like that would help with the crazy power creep. I thought that sets rotating out was lame until I started playing Magic, and I get why it's important for balance. Well, in concept anyway. Magic's power creep has been wild lately. I have heard that. So the age-old, should Yu-Gi-Oh have rotation thing?
It's just hard to start a rotation in a game that doesn't rotate.
Yeah. So a lot of Bandai games have been moving towards kind of these types of... Like, first of all, a lot of them have been converging with their Japanese counterparts in releases, right, which is a good thing. I would love to see Yu-Gi-Oh! Do that. I know that's not 100% like what the question is, but I think that would be good. However, I do know that some of them are incorporating rotation. Like, is it One Piece is doing it now, I think? Is it One Piece?
I think One Piece is starting a rotation if they haven't already started it. And like all the Bandai card games, they have like indicators on the cards that will make it very easy for them to start a rotation if they so chose.
Yeah, but I think that you're right. You can expound on that point if you want, because I don't think that Yu-Gi-Oh! Has an infrastructure in place for rotation. So that's where so much of the friction, I believe, comes from.
Yeah, Yu-Gi-Oh players actually hate being told what to do, and it's come up time and time again. Konami, you know, for years, they use ban lists to get you to buy new product. They want you to buy a new product. We're going to ban everything else you were playing, so now you have to buy the new stuff. A rotation helps to solve that problem because it naturally rotates out your older cards, so you do need to get the newer cards. But we've seen what happens when Yu-Gi-Oh! Players get told they can't use their old cards. Remember Master Rule 4?
Yeah, I think that there would be a lot of friction. And in a game where, you know, in a game where the things already feel so on edge at times with people, mm-hmm. like, you know, you already have this crowd of people who, admittedly, they're, a lot of them aren't even really active players, but there's a crowd of people who are very like, you know, Synchro's ruined this, Xyz ruined this, whatever, like, Yu-Gi-Oh's gone to hell and all this stuff. And so now to also tell those people, like, well, you can't even play your old cards, sure, some of them don't even play to begin with, but, like, there'd be a lot of backlash and stuff to that, because
it would be a bitter fight.
I even think of, like, if a rotation came out today and they said maybe only things in the last 2 years can be played, and suddenly, like, people are told they can't play, like, Labyrinth, let's say. Like, a fan favorite, like,
my Lab. My poor zombie deck.
Or Branded or Sky Striker, because those aren't kind of in the rotation. I think people would be really mad. Now, I know that with rotation, the idea is that you can still strategically reprint certain staples, and any right. staple that's been reprinted in the rotation period can still be used. But Yu-Gi-Oh! Has not printed with that in mind so far. So I think the initial pushback would be so great that Konami is, dare I say, I think wise to not even poke that bear.
Well, I do think we're in a better place for it now than we've ever been before mm-hmm. because of Genesis format.
Okay.
A format that's literally designed so that you can use any of your old cards, no matter how bad and old they are. Because of Genesis, there is now an avenue to use cards that the advanced format says you can't. So if we were to start a rotation, which I don't think is likely, you're not completely lost on your Sky Striker deck, right?
Yeah.
They might need to readjust some points if we do it, though.
Now, one thing I will say that, like, Yu-Gi-Oh, you know, rotation's interesting because, like, it kind of seems like it's mostly targeted towards intermediate to competitive crowds. Like, obviously, like, if you're a casual player, you might just choose to almost ignore the rotation. I don't know. Yu-Gi-Oh! Already, in terms of, like, how the power creep has developed, really has rotation. I mean, like, the ban list rotates stuff out, and the power creep rotates stuff out, where, whether you want to admit it or not, stuff released in, like, 2022 kind of isn't keeping up anyway. Like, I'm not saying that that is, like, good or bad. Like, I'm not assigning a label of, like, that's a great thing or a bad thing to this, but just that, like, when you look at what people are playing, there are decks that are, like, at what you might call full power, like Lab or something. There's no one's playing them. Like, it's, they have been literally just rotated out without even needing to be formally rotated out. And but maybe there's, maybe, like, Yu-Gi-Oh! And Konami, like, they're maybe just satisfied with, like, giving you the freedom to play Lab. I'm using Lab as an example. This could be many decks released in that kind of period of time. But just, they're not going to formally tell you you can't play it. They're just going to be like, well, it doesn't have maybe what it takes to hang today, but if you can figure it out, have at it.
Now, I thought rotation implies that a card that can rotate out and also rotate back in.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's kind of what Yu-Gi-Oh's missing as far, like, We can disenfranchise a deck or strategy, but we can't re-enfranchise them. Oh, was that even a phrase? I don't think that maybe was. But yeah, once you take a deck out of the so-called rotation, in Yu-Gi-Oh, we don't really have an easy way of bringing them back. Usually, once you're out, you're done. You're done, Ski. There's, like, unless your name is Zoo and a few other decks, it's hard to come back after you've been booted out.
Or typically when a deck comes back, it's, like, even an example of Zodiac, right? Like, it'll come back in a different way than it was.
Comes back as an engine.
Yeah, it comes back as an engine. That's a good way to simplify it. It's like, usually it'll just come back in, like, the most lean engine, kind of, like, what's the most abusable part of this? And the identity might be sort of lost, but, like, you know.
What do you think is the oldest card that that still sees, like, plenty of use today?
Technically MSD right now. But, yeah, to answer the question more honestly,
I was thinking, like, Effect Veiler or
Effect Veiler, Solemn Warning.
Oh, Solemn Warning is old.
Solemn Judgment is used. It's got limited recently. So
hey, Dark Hole is old. I mean, you don't see it as
old. Oh, I like the Floodgates that are still around, like Rivalry and Gozen. I'm trying to think of, like, a monster that's, like, a core kind of like an actual monster that's it's used
hard.
Today?
I mean, it's hard. If it's not a, if not effect Veiler, I feel like it's hard for a monster to stick around.
Yeah, the monsters go fast. Like, people are kind of... It's funny that even cards like Kashtira, Fenrir, or even, like, God forbid, Dino Wrestler, Pankratops, are feeling like kind of retro now by today's standards.
Yeah, you don't see them as in as many side like, decks as they once were.
Yeah, or like what used to have been like a fun main deck tech or whatever, like their niche side options. Like, yeah, I don't know. Yu-Gi-Oh! It rotates the monsters pretty hard.
Yeah.
So,
it's another one I hope that we answered at some point.
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think that Yu-Gi-Oh! Might work better, but I don't think that it would. I think that introducing rotation now just seems... I have a hard time imagining it even happening.
Agreed. What personal favorite cards would you like to see as overframe rare? I have a feeling Alec will say Ancient Gear Golem, so he's not allowed to pick that one. My personal favorite would be Orgoth the Relentless or a retrain of it. My answer is Ancient Gear Golem.
Yeah. Well, this is a fun, quick question. I would like to see, and I know that they probably aren't even allowed to do this, but I would love to see full art or overframes of, like, well, first of all, I don't know if the question is, like, this the card's original art just as an overframe, or if it's, like, a new art of the card.
Because that is a good point.
My answer was going to be, I'd love to see the Kazuki Takahashi Jinzo art. Where, because I think it would work well as an overframe, the one where he's kind of like got the, there's like the electricity coming out and that's like the pose. I think that would look cool as an overframe because like the kind of energy would be like flowing out to the edges of the card and, you know, and I obviously like Jinzo a lot. So that would probably be my pick. But if it's something that gets a new picture, that might change my answer. What about you?
Since I can't pick Ancient Gear Golem, you know, I'd like to see my gadgets as overframes. I like gadgets. They're favorites of mine.
I don't know. I feel like they wouldn't do much in the frame, though, because they're so static monsters. Like, they don't really...
I'm not trying to impress you.
No, I'm just I'm just offering an opinion.
I'm picking.
Do you know what a card thing would work? Is a gadget trio as an overframe.
No, I want individual that. Ones want for individual. Each
So gadget. Would you want them to just, like, just size up the picture?
Yes.
Like, 50% bigger and then just... Yes, I would. Okay, I don't know. If it's a monster, I think it's like a new picture. I don't have an answer right now, but I will tell you a recent one that I think disappointed me. Which was one? Toon Blue Eyes White Dragon, or Blue Eyes Toon Dragon. They recently showed the overframe version of that.
I haven't seen it yet.
You're not missing much, because it's actually what I think that the gadgets kind of are, which
I
is like,
gotta see this.
They just upsized it by like, maybe 30%, and it's just kind of slightly coming out of the frame, and that's it. Like, there's...
Sometimes a design is perfect, as is Paul.
I just found it was kind of, like, boring for an overframe. Like, with my overframes, I want to either see the dynamism of the monster itself. Like, it's, like, you know, doing some pose and kind of, like, flying out at you or using an attack. Or I want to see, like...
Oh, yeah, this is majestic. I don't care what you're talking about.
I'm with the Blue-Eyes Toon Dragon.
Yeah, this guy's gorgeous.
Yeah, like, it's all right. Or I want to see, like, the energy from its attack. Like, the electricity or the, like, the flames. Like, that should be coming through the edges of the card, so.
A card that came to mind for me was actually, because I was thinking of my favorite cards. And so, of course, I think Ancient Gear Golem, but I think of gadgets, but I think of Legacy of Darkness, my favorite set of all time. And I was like, you know what would be cool to get, like, an overframe retrain Injection Fairy Lily?
They could have so much fun with it.
It could be done. It could be done really well.
Yeah, she's got the syringe, and it's
just give her a busted little effect too.
Yeah, I would. Okay, I don't know why I obsess as much as I do over these monsters. I would love to see, because this is also, you mentioned Legacy of Darkness Last Turn, which I don't know if it actually came in that set, but it's got like
it's got the Hinokagasuchi
and Yamato Dragon Hinokagasuchi. Imagine like. Them like fighting on like an overframe card. I feel like that would look
good.
That would look
so
awesome. Okay. The next question. Are there any times you can think of in which a deck got a support card or cards which made the deck less unique or interesting? Yes, plenty. My example is Dark World Silva because of how it over centralizes the deck around a toxic win condition. In the case of Dark World Silva, it's just a hand loop. Can you think of any?
Okay. Well, even some hot takes. Relax. Okay. So I feel like this question and the example they gave are a little different.
Oh, okay.
Because This is when a deck got a support card that made the deck less unique or interesting. When Silva was first printed, it was not immediately used as a hand loop card.
Yeah, it's actually funny that they did mention Silva, because Silva was not the new support at all. Silva was one of the first Dark World cards that existed. I think it actually came in the set that Dark World debuted in. It's that, you know, so much new support allowed that old card to be exploited. So, you know, you can make that argument. But to just address the general question, I sometimes hate when old decks get new support. Because what you often find
changes the deck.
Is it the deck just changes?
I think my favorite and, of course, least favorite example is Gladiator Beast.
Yeah.
Glads historically had a time honored play style of battle tagging is what I always called it. But when they got their kind of like Arc 5 era of support, I picked up the Glad cards, and because Paul had regaled me with tales of Glads for years at that point.
Yeah, I was a big Gladiator Beast fan.
So I picked it all up, and then I proceeded to just cheat out fusion monsters for my extra deck over and over again.
Yeah, like editors kind of just spamming them out.
I was like, this doesn't feel very Glad-y.
Yeah, I know what you mean, where it's tough because what ends up happening in Yu-Gi-Oh! A lot is that At its core, Yu-Gi-Oh!, as we've established, has changed a lot over the years. And different eras of Yu-Gi-Oh! Can sometimes look so unrecognizable from a previous one that, like, when it comes to supporting old decks and old cards, truthfully, most just can't be helped. Like, Glads are trying to do something that fundamentally does not matter in Yu-Gi-Oh! Anymore. It's like getting these small little monsters to be able to kind of attack and then swap and then whatever, battle phase. Doesn't work. And so if you want to make Glads work, then you have to take some of the small old aspects of them that were decent and then make new cards that kind of just abuse those few good things that sort of aged okay. And like what that looks like for Glads is editor, usually kind of just summoning out like the new one, Doma Tianis, and then like Heraklinos, which is like an old Glad that has a spell trap negate.
It was nice to use Heraklinos, but we were only using him for a negate.
You're just using him for the negate, and so it doesn't feel like you actually even like contact fused into him. And there's so many decks that kind of are the same way, like Six Samurai fit in that kind of in that crowd. I think of to some degree, like Lightsworn, even like I like some of the newer Lightsworn support, but like maybe that's not even like the support, maybe it's just the way that players choose to use it.
Well, for Lightsworn, I think they just kind of went to the... Konami enabled us to go to the natural extreme of Lightsworn, which is, well, kind of just mill yourself out and then trigger everything in Grave and go crazy.
I think what it... You know what it really comes down to for me is that Yu-Gi-Oh! Compresses so much stuff into one turn, because that's the expectation. Mm-hmm. Your deck needs to be doing all that it's going to do in that first turn. Like, whether you're playing some slow-ass Odeon Stun or the world's most cybers combo slot pile, no matter which of those you're playing, they might feel like they're on opposite ends of the playstyle spectrum, but regardless, by the end of the first turn, their goal is to have set it all up. And so, if you want to retrain an old archetype, you have to push it to the extreme of, like, how can we give you the Gladiator Beast experience in one turn? How can we give you the Lightsworn experience in one turn?
Mail half your deck in that one turn. Yeah. That's how you do it.
More than half, right? More, right? Like, it's just because you need to be milling everything, constantly summoning monsters, constantly, like, overlaying them and, you know, making them nervous and synchroing and all this stuff, and we'll only build in a way to, like, kind of prevent you from decking out. So, like, you know, the new Judgment Dragon guys that, like, kind of prevent your stuff from being banished, or they recycle it, or, you know, however that goes. But, like, you have to push it to the extreme. And so in that way, it will never be able to really be what you remember of Lightsworn's.
Yeah.
It won't be able to be what you remember of Dark Worlds, where it's kind of like a one or two discards per turn, get a little bit of card economy and some plus ones. Oh, I pitched Brow and got like one extra draw. I pitched, you know, Grin and got a spell trap pop. No. You it's going to be like, how many times can I spam Graffa? How many times can I spam this new like rainbow or whatever? Can I rip my opponent's hand out and end on this board of, you know, Link Fours? Because there's no time to play that tango.
Yeah.
So, sadly, you get that with so many archetypes.
I have one more example, and that's zombies.
Oh, okay.
It's controversial to say this, but I honestly hate Baylor Drock.
He was like a 2018 kind of
somewhere 2019 around there. Okay. Like Baylor Drock was such a strong zombie that it now changed the direction of any zombie deck that could be built. Now, if you're playing zombies, you're playing a Baylor Drock deck. Why? He's a strong monster. What does that mean now? Well, now you're playing now when Zombie World was kind of maybe a tech. Now you really want to play Zombie World. Which, if you're playing Zombie World, you might as well run Rivalry too, because it's a strong board setup. And it's like, okay, if I'm running Zombie World, I'm running Rivalry, I'm running Baylor Drock. So what does that mean? Necro World Banshee, Glow Up Bloom, Unizombie. Like, now your decks are getting really homogenous. When I started playing my zombies, it was a very simple level 8 synchro spam strategy. I wasn't making zombie synchros. I just make generic synchros. And the deck felt very flexible because as we got different cards, I was able to like tech in things like Dark Arm Dragon, and we got Malicious. And I was able to do all these different things. So you weren't
a big Baylor Drock?
Because Baylor Drock then kind of just forced zombie decks to all look the same.
I will say, like, one shout out. I think it needs bone support. The recent bone support, I think, deserves a lot of credit for trying to be its own thing and not just fit into the Baylor Drock soup. Mm-hmm. Like, you can obviously still run it. I'm sure there are lots of builds that do. But I like they gave enough cards that feel like they are self sufficient and don't just want you to, like, okay, Zombie World again. Like, you know. So.
But I guess even back then, Mizuki was kind of our guy who kind of.
Yeah, Goblin Zombie, Mizuki.
So, yeah, I guess that's fair.
Plague Spreader. That's one. Okay. I've been craving Tag Force games recently again. I know that we got the first Rush Duel game, but do you think we could get another stretch of single-player Yu-Gi-Oh! Games? Do you want that, or do you prefer just Master Duel? This is a wonderful question. I want to direct you to a video that we recently did on the main Team APS channel, going kind of over the history of Yu-Gi-Oh! Video games. We talked for like an hour and a half about pretty much this topic square on.
By the end of that video, you'll know our answer.
So really, that'd probably be a great... You'll get a lot more from that, but... Anyway, sorry.
Quick version. To answer your first question, it was... do you think we'll get another stretch of single-player Yu-Gi-Oh! Video games? No. And that's not because I don't want them. It's because Konami is not much of a video game company anymore. Like, they make
Yu-Gi-Oh!-wise, yeah.
Like, well, even outside of it. Like, they make video games, but they don't make video games like they used to make video games.
They
lean into the franchises that sell the best, and they've basically cut off the franchises that don't. Yu-Gi-Oh! Single-player games would be considered kind of niche in Konami's portfolio.
Yeah.
So I just don't think they would actually go through.
Konami's new thing, and you can actually see this as a trend in many Japanese gaming studios, is they have found their grail franchises, and they will remake and remaster and repackage them into Infinity. And, like, you know, we see that in the case of Konami with, like, Silent Hill and Metal Gear Solid, where, you know, that recent Metal Gear game is, like, Delta or whatever. It's like a collection or whatever, those old games.
Yep.
And same with, like, Silent Hill. They kind of just... They will take these franchises they know that go well, and, like, that's their safe remakes. As Yu-Gi-Oh! Goes, I think that what they found for Yu-Gi-Oh! And this is unfortunate. I don't like it, but what I think they have found is it works best as just, like, a live service gacha game. They will milk Duel Links and Master Duel until the ends of time. And new gacha games that don't work, such as Cross Duel, will be snipped quickly, right? And you won't get single-player games. I think that, optimistically speaking, what you'll probably get are Yu-Gi-Oh! Mid-Days Collection. Because we got Early Days Collection. Mid-Days.
That sounds, that sounds like something you might call Early Days.
Yeah. You know, they did Early Days Collection. I have no clue how well that game sold. I heard that it sold, like, pretty decently. I don't know where I read that, but
I'd hope so.
Like, you know, it's an easy way to just compile a bunch of stuff they've already released in years past, market it to the crowd of people who are nostalgic for Yu-Gi-Oh! They'll buy it, like they bought Early Days Collection and realize all these games are kind of the same, And, you know, maybe we will get a Middays collection that has more of that stuff from, like, the GameCube, PS2, Xbox, maybe the Wii. I think we could perhaps see something like that. And it's like, oh, it's Duels of the Roses, it's Frostbound Kingdom. But for Konami, it will be a low investment, you know.
You know, these companies, they're very risk-averse, Konami especially. And so I don't see them giving us single-player Yu-Gi-Oh! Video games again. Though I really would like it if they did.
I really would. That would be, it'd be wonderful. I didn't get to fully experience the Tag Force games. I only owned, like, one of them. I didn't play it much. But there is an aspect of the Tag Force games that's in Crossduel, like the whole kind of character partner companion right. thing and getting cool exclusive lines. And they even, I mean, they animated, they had kind of the 2D animation for the characters. They did voice acting in Crossduel, but nobody played it. Or, sorry, not enough people played it and spent money on it for it to be, you know, successful. And so it's sunset, and they will, the lesson they will likely take away from that is that you good-for-nothing, ungrateful players won't buy our stuff, so we'll never make another again.
But just to be clear,
we want
them. We yeah. want single-player Yu-Gi-Oh! Games.
Yeah. As I've said,
and if you want to hear more on that, you can watch
our video. Watch the full video for our full thoughts. But, yeah. Okay, you're next.
Hey, homies. I've been watching for a little over 2 years now and love the videos, as well as y'all's ability to be so transparent on subjects, even if they don't pertain to you. I was wondering about your thoughts regarding the meta's role in new decks / packs or set releases in Yu-Gi-Oh! How do you think Konami could improve to get more duelists into the game at younger ages? And do you think that there's a way, if any, to get meta and casual players to agree on value and playability on cards with new releases and ban lists? Thanks again, guys. Love y'all videos. And please get Alec to read this question. I know he hates long ones. My God!
Well, it's worked out that way.
How did that happen? I chose the order.
Well, you know, you can't win them all. This is a wonderful question. So I'm not entirely, so it's a broad question. There's a lot to say about it. I'll try to focus on just a couple of aspects of it, at least like little straight thoughts of mine. Alec is like fuming over here. I had to read this long question.
I feel bamboozled.
What do you think? Like, how, there's two major parts. How do you get more duelists into the game at younger ages? And how do you, if it's even possible, get like meta players and casual players to agree on value and playability as in regards to new sets and ban lists?
It's, both are quite difficult at the advanced age that Yu-Gi-Oh! Is in. I think as far as getting younger people into Yu-Gi-Oh!, we're going to need some type of a presence on the platforms that
younger they consume. Younger people.
If like kids are actually just brain dead on TikTok, Yu-Gi-Oh! Needs to be on TikTok.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting, but that's pretty much what I also concluded, is that like, it's two things. There is not an anime right now. I know this is like we're beating a dead horse here, but Yu-Gi-Oh! Needs an anime that helps in so many ways with like onboarding new interests, both for people our age and for young people too. Like there's got to be something that is like an anime, some other medium that is like
pulling you have you to in. Have something new that's interesting, because you can't expect like 8-year-old Jimmy to go and watch Yu-Gi-Oh! DM because his great grandfather said he liked it.
Yeah,
like
the best that you'll get in that department is like, I've seen some people, like, you know, who are in their 30s, and they're like, yeah, like, I'm making my kids watch, like, what I watched when I grew up. Like, you'll see these videos where people, like, showing their kids, like, DM and GX. And it's kind of cute and endearing, but it's also, like, that's not really going to be the norm of
experience. But I do feel like in 30 years, we'll be getting retrospective some kids who are forced to watch their, like, their parents' favorite things and how that messed them up as children.
Yeah, Dad's reheated leftovers mean that I have no sense of media literacy or identity for myself. Okay. Like, the TikTok and, like, all that stuff. I feel so old saying the TikTok. But, like,
the TikTok?
Maybe there is an approach where you kind of, like, put Yu-Gi-Oh! Onto these platforms for people to just find in short snippets and bits. I have noticed a trend of a lot of old anime, like, Gundam's doing this and, like, all this old anime, where they're just putting their whole library of anime onto YouTube now.
Yeah.
Where people can just kind of go and watch it. Now, that won't necessarily, like, end up in front of a kid necessarily all the time, but like
it's a start.
But I do think it's a start, and I think like maybe the next step is actually to, you know, have it where like if you're scrolling on TikTok or Reels or YouTube Shorts, that just Yu-Gi-Oh! Episode 1, Part 1 of 20, because it's a 20-minute episode and they're just split into like little 60-second chunks, will just play, and then the algorithm just plays the next part and then play. And like, I know it sounds crazy to us to like kind of ingest it in those terms, but like, that could be, I guess, how Yu-Gi-Oh! Could be presented to a younger, lower attention span person. There's
multiple of those kind of like short form video platforms where they tell long form stories, but through the medium of shorts.
Yeah.
They do exist. I have no idea how popular they are, but I imagine that kids today are probably more into that than to like logging into Crunchyroll.
Mm-hmm. There's also Fortnite.
Yeah, Roblox. Fortnite, Roblox. I'm assuming the kids still play those. What's my little brother play? Gorilla Tag. We got to get Yu-Gi-Oh! And Gorilla Tag.
I don't know what that is.
I still don't know. He just kind of runs around with his VR helmet on and he hits things.
All right, how do we get the meta and the casuals to agree on value and playability of cards? The cynic in me says impossible. But what do we think?
So the way I look at this question, because it might not be how it's intended, I actually look at it as getting casual and competitive players to actually want to buy like sealed product.
Okay, yeah.
And I put that almost so like squarely on the back of Konami, because I've seen Bandai does it fairly easily with their card games. Their product is desired by everybody in their space because they found a way to cater to both like competitive types and collector types all in one product. Only recently with Overframes do I think Yu-Gi-Oh! Has really tried to cater to more like casual collectory types.
Yeah, I think this is something that's going to be interesting to revisit after Chaos Origin. Mm-hmm. I think that right now my answer would be like Yu-Gi-Oh! Hasn't done a great job of it in the last several years and it's kind of suffered for it.
And that we need better pull rates for good cards that people want to use.
But as it looks right now, I think that Chaos Origins seems to be attempting to address a lot of those things. Both Overframes, which are kind of more of a collector's thing, a little bit more casual focused, like if you're a casual collector, whatever. And also this archetypes built out of the box design that they seem to be pushing, where, you know, the things you can pull in this product are buildable out of the box, which is going to take doing the right rarity ratios, like you said. Like, and you need to be able to feasibly pull them out of like just a couple boxes, not like 20. And also like that they are kind of siloed, so you don't feel like you're missing out on too much.
Because I honestly do think competitive players historically, you know, buy singles, buy singles, buy singles. And they were correct to say so. But I do think there is a time element, because you can buy singles, but you might be waiting like 2 to 3 weeks to actually get all the cards you need for your new competitive deck. But if the pull rates in Chaos Origins are, you know, buttery smooth the way I'd like them to be, then your shop might have, let's say, four to six cases of Chaos Origins. And within those 4 to 6 cases, there are enough of the cards that people need to actually build their decks. They'll opt to just buy at their local shop because they'll get the cards in hand immediately.
Yeah, that's kind of how you flip the script on the whole like buy singles thing, is that you do have to make the products feel worthwhile to where it actually like overshadows the appeal of buying singles and waiting. Is that buying the pack feels so enticing and fun and like in the immediacy of it. Yep. You know, kind of. So I think that I would like to revisit this after Chaos Origins. I think we'll see if that kind of that formula, maybe even Rarity Collection 5, because it's going to be introducing the Overframes, but you know, and see if these things play out the way that they seemingly are intended to play out.
There is one thing that could throw a wrench in all of it, because Konami can do this correctly and still get screwed. If the cards end up too desirable and then the market prices on boxes go up to like an uncomfortable degree,
yeah,
and that could just throw a wrench in all of this.
We shall see. Okay, next question. This gets out of the Yu-Gi-Oh! And into the fun or weird territory. Just have a few of them. Uh-oh. Hey guys, if you had the choice of being isekai into another fantasy verse, manga, video game, or otherwise, what would it be? Love you lots from Swag Lizard.
Oh, that's a heart. I thought that was sideways testicles.
You know, for as old as you are, you should know what less than three means.
No one's ever sent it to me, Paul.
Ooh, that says a lot. So, you get isekai'd into a fantasy verse. What's it going to be?
Oh, my God. Why you got to do me like that? Because anything cool that I like, I would definitely not want to go there.
I think that is actually a fun thing that, or an unfun thing that nobody wants to talk about is like, these a lot of these cool anime worlds, if you just got like simply transferred there with like nothing special, you're not the protagonist, you don't like maybe have a power, a lot of them would just suck.
Like the vast majority of Gundam is just war crimes. Are you sure you want to get isekai'd into a Gundam franchise? Maybe Gundam Build Fighters, but that's the only one.
I remember somebody was like, I want to be in Attack on Titan. Like, you what?
That's insane.
I want to be in Kaiju number 8. What?
No, bad no, you idea. Like,
your house gets destroyed like, and you probably get killed.
Paul, you want to go to Fire Force?
No. Like the great cataclysm is happening.
Well, it's okay, like, my bad. JJK.
Even worse.
You get isekai as a JJK and Sukuna's standing right behind you.
I think, like, you know, my two go-tos, I've always said, like, you know, it'd be fun to be, like, in Harry Potter, right? Like, I know that's a, it's like a cheap kind of cop-out answer. Who wouldn't want to be a wizard and all this stuff? Although, even Paul's that like world.
He'd be a Death Eater.
I would not be a Death Eater. But I will say that world has
some. You don't get
control
of where you're isekai'd.
It's true. That world has some fucked up parts, too, though. Like, it's, the money doesn't make sense in Harry Potter. You know, there's a lot of casual racism. I guess it's not that different from the real world. I say My Hero Academia is my pick. Because even if you have a kind of useless quirk, which many people in My Hero do, like civilians, true. There is a system in place where there are heroes who tend to solve the problems. Sometimes you can still be a victim.
I mean, I distinctly remember in the final, like, arc of My Hero, where there was just a giant crater where a city was.
Yeah, that's true. Like, we're talking just kind of a normal day in the world of My Hero. Like,
you don't have any control of that.
I wouldn't mind being, like, in the, what is it, in the vigilantes? Naruhata, right? Okay. I was living there, like, the worst thing that happens is some drugs are going around that turn people into kaijus. I'll
be stuck
but,
in the sky egg during.
You know, it could be theoretically chill. Like, theoretically, okay, it could
fair.
Be chill.
That's fair.
What about you? Where are you going?
Oh, man. This is the objectively correct answer, and okay. I'm surprised you didn't think of it. Pokemon.
That's so true.
Like, nothing so bad happens in Pokemon where I didn't really be worried.
But what about, like, the Kyogre thing?
But they stop it. It doesn't actually happen.
Your town might have still flooded.
Well... That's in one...
Pacific Log Town was underwater.
That was one game. And look, they never talk about people dying in those games. So I assume no one died.
Okay. That's actually probably true. No one died. I mean, Pokemon is a utopia. Like, it doesn't even
I had a Whalmer. It knew dive.
Pokemon's got free healthcare?
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, you just go like, to Pokemon.
The inflation in their economy is incredible. Like, everyone's rich.
Yeah, people just... Inflation kind of doesn't really seem to exist. There isn't even really crime because outside of this single group of enemy kind of teams or whatever per region, no one otherwise seems to steal anything or hurt anybody.
Yeah, they're like the bad guy teams aren't really thieves anymore.
One thing that people do understate about Pokemon is like you could totally just like get the one or two Pokemon you like and then just like live your life in peace.
Yeah. Like, and then outside of like red, blue, like the Gen 1, things stop dying.
Yeah.
Like, true. There's like a few cemeteries in all of Pokemon. Like, three cemeteries in total.
Yeah, Pokemon's probably the safe choice. Go to Pokemon. Catch your favorites, live a life till you're old with your, like, small, cute dog thing or whatever.
I would have a Lopunny.
No. I would have all the dog Pokemon, though. I would just live in a house with all the dog Pokemon.
It would be chaotic. It would be a chaotic mess.
Okay. Oh, I read this last one, so.
Oh, yeah.
You get the next one.
Hey! A bit more of a random question for the two of you, but some other podcasts ask it to guess, and I always like the answers. What's your favorite food, and where is your favorite place to eat? Then, to make it Yu-Gi-Oh! Related, which food archetype would you choose if you had to eat it for a meal? This podcast is my eagerly awaited listen weekly, or my weekly listen, and always brightens my Thursday up. Much love from Canada, the place where British Columbia is, you goofs.
See, I knew that. You didn't. Just to be clear, I was mostly sure that British Columbia wasn't.
Come on. British Columbia, those are two different things. You know what? Of course it's in Canada. A place named two different things? Canadian. I don't know why I didn't think of that.
So, favorite food and where you specifically like to eat it from?
All right. Well, I'm a very simple boy from the Louisiana South. I like seafood. Where do I like to eat it? On a blanket, on the fairgrounds, sun blaring, music playing. Crawfish, crab.
I don't know if I have, like, I used to always tell people my favorite food was actually cheeseburgers, which I actually, it still kind of is. Like, I'm a cheeseburger guy. I like a good burger. I'm more, that's of all the foods that I eat, that's probably the one that I'm the most particular about it being done well or not.
Okay.
Like, I like smash burgers. There actually was a place called Smash Burger that I would eat at a lot.
Yeah, Smash Burger is a place.
Like, I have a favorite. I'm just trying to think, what's my favorite burger place? Maybe it's In-N-Out.
Woo, Paul, your maybe taste it's
is. Well, I'm talking about like chain, you know, chain places. Like, In-N-Out, Steak Shack, those are the good ones.
Wow. I mean, like, I don't hate those places. I
can never, I can eat a McDonald's burger.
Anywhere close fine, to where I mentioned my favorite food. But
hey, like, do you have a favorite, like, restaurant for seafood?
My favorite, I don't know if anybody would even know about it, but there's a place in Louisiana called Perino's. It's on the West Bank off of the expressway. I want to say it's in Gretna. It might be in Gretna or it could be in Harvey. Anyway, but Perino's Seafood, that's my favorite place. I would go there with my dad all the time. Usually when I visit home, we usually go there. Love that place.
I've also gotten into ramen lately. I've become more of a ramen, like, I...
It becomes a hot take?
No. I've become more of a ramen guy, I think, in recent... Like, I used to kind of just be indifferent to it, but I've noticed such a change in the last decade of, like, ramen being a very normalized thing. Like, there was a period of time where, finding ramen was kind of tough. And when you would go there, it'd be like, the clientele was, like, just a very specific sort of person. Whereas now, like, you'll just see everybody in a ramen shop.
Yeah, ramen is popping up. Like, it's a family restaurant, especially if you're in like a university kind of town. Mm-hmm. They always find their way around universities. And you know, there was actually not this year, but just last year, there was like a month period where I was like getting ramen like at the end of every week. I was ordering some ramen. And I was like, I need my weekly bowl.
Yeah, yeah, I've gotten the ramen. Is there anything else? I don't know if there's anything else that I like.
As a kid, like, I had a very childish sense of, like, taste. Mac and cheese is my favorite as a kid.
Yeah.
Love me some mac and cheese.
Yeah, I've gotten
I like the cheap stuff, too.
Oh, God.
Not even good mac and cheese.
Yeah, the poor taste.
I want the powder, and I want the powder not to have, like, as much water in it so you can still taste a bit of powder in it. Yeah.
Oh, gross.
I did not have expensive tastes as a kid.
Good question, though.
There was the archetype thing.
Oh, yeah. What archetype are we? Are you eating? I feel like you can't say Madolche, even though it's like kind of the clear. I know yours
would be. No, I would not want to eat things that look like they're alive.
Not all the Madolche even look alive.
Which Madolche look dead?
Well, there's like parts of the Madolche world that are just in the background that you can eat.
Okay, but the Madolche monsters.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to eat the monsters.
Like, I've eaten like crawfish and things that we boil alive, but it's clearly dead when I eat it. Do I have to kill the what's his name? Messangelato before I can eat him? I don't want
to. So, what archetype are you doing? I've got one for you. I'm wondering if you have the same one.
Let me think. I gotta make sure I think of all the food archetypes. So
there's a lot.
Like, sushi-ps are up there because it's sushi, and I like sushi.
Yeah, that was going to be mine. I was going to say, like, you should say, I figured you would.
Like, that's the one that comes to mind.
Sushi would be what you would eat.
I can't think of it. There's no other, like,
there's like Nouvelles.
Nouvelles, they have a few different foods.
Yeah. Nouvelle actually doesn't even have that many. It even has some food, sort of, but like, it's really more like, it is Because the Nouvelle monsters are like these demons. Yeah. And then some of the supports are like these chefs. But there aren't that many foods in there.
Yeah, the foods are just in artworks, but they're not like monsters. Not necessarily.
I would go to whatever the restaurant is. The
recipes are like spells, so.
Yeah, I would go to whatever the restaurant is and just see what they've got.
I wouldn't go somewhere where a demon is serving me.
You've probably already been in a place where a demon is serving you, so not. There's one. I feel like there's another food archetype I'm like just forgetting.
Oh, there's the Hungry Burgers got merged with.
Yeah, it got kind of shuffled into, you know, like the hollow roast beef or ghost beef, mild turkey.
Oh yeah, I remember those.
Those are like I could eat some of those.
Ghost beef looked good.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm forgetting like a food archetype, but for me, I'm gonna just go with like. I will go to the Nouvelle restaurant and see what they are serving.
We'll serve you a hungry burger.
Yeah. And if I have to eat a hungry burger, did you see in Japan, actually, they just announced a cup ramen collab with Yu-Gi-Oh!
Oh, I don't want to go down this road again. You get
instant fusion cup ramen or whatever.
Guys, we had the Winged Dragon of ramen. That was some, what was that? 5 years
ago? Some years back.
Yeah. The Winged Dragon of ramen was not good.
Yeah.
So I don't.
We didn't prepare it very well, though, if I'm remembering correctly. Because we like tried.
Followed the instructions.
No, we had like a microwave and we were trying to like split it into different bowls and like heat up the water. Yeah. And it was
we
like
only had like 2 cups.
It was a weird.
Yeah.
I don't think we gave it justice.
I don't think anything could have saved it. The noodles tasted.
It was also very old, though.
Yeah.
But I will try the cup ramen. I'll try the Yu-Gi-Oh! Cup ramen.
Gotta import it.
I'll give it a crack. I'm looking into it right now. I have already reached out to one of our OCG contacts, and I'm going to try to get some instant fusion cup ramen, and we will try it live on this podcast. Probably not, but we'll try it eventually.
I'm not against it.
Okay, well, thank you for the question, and the final one that I figured would be good to... Oh, God. Oh, okay, wait. It's the SD card has limited space remaining, okay, so we have 7 more minutes to talk.
Okay, cool.
Great, wonderful. I'm glad it didn't stop the recording. Thank goodness. I'm glad it told me that, too. What do you think of songs that are written by humans but sung with AI? Now, before you say hate it, next question, Alec, hear me out, this person says.
They are calling me out this time.
Yeah, they are. Many people can write music, but not all of them can sing or afford to hire someone who can sing. It makes music making more accessible to these people and keeps a human creative element to them. While real singers will always be valued more, this allows for more songwriters to be heard by people who normally wouldn't be able to hear their songs. Also, keep in mind, I'm referring more to small-scale creators and writers who make songs for fun or as a hobby, as opposed to big music companies or producers wanting to make big bucks easily. Don't worry, Alec, I'm still against the majority of AI products, especially art, but I still see some use for it as a carefully used tool.
I feel so targeted. Okay, so the act of songwriting is in itself its own art form that is actually separate from the performance of song, of singing, right? They are both different art forms, and I completely support a human written like musical composition. I love that. I still don't love the idea of a song, even if it's written by a human, being sung by an AI voice. However, I do think there's room for there to be a discourse on that. Because at the end of the day, I truly just want there to be some kind of a human element into the art that I consume.
Yeah.
And while I'm initially against it, I wouldn't mind seeing the like tug of war and push and pull that might cause in the art realm.
I like that this person did sort of include the fact that, you know, this is something, because this actually feels a lot similar to me to something that like Alex maybe described, where, you know, like he's playing D&D and they'll use like, you know, a generative AI tool to sort of like make a render of like, this is what my character maybe looks like in this world, to give themselves like a starting point, because you're playing a game of D&D, you don't have like a professional artist on hand, and so this can quickly show you how your character might look. Call up
the most expensive artist you can right now.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
Draft their characters.
Yeah, commission them for like $1,000. No, but I do think that like if you have written the song and this feels like a great like sounding board type of thing. You have written a song and, you know, you obviously maybe can't, you can write the song, you know what you want to say, but you can't sing it and you can't like hire someone to sing it. And you just want to like test this out and see how this would sound if sung. I think that's a, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like a more ethical use of AI. Like, I don't know. You know, like, eh.
I plant myself against it, but art isn't like a thing that has hard rules, honestly. And if the art community wants to take on that battle and just like decide whether or not like AI singing human written songs is a valuable piece of artwork, time will tell. And I wouldn't mind seeing people wrestle with that.
Yeah. I mean, I also think that if you, one tricky part is like, you know, who is like, is it one of those AI voices that's like pretending, like it's just like copying, like this is, as if Adele sang the song or Kanye West sang the song, I don't love those because that's still kind of like taking a singer, artist, or rapper's like likeness and having them sing it. Mm. But if it's kind of more like it's a set of generic voices you can pick from and they will like sing this song that you've written and you can use, just like get you, hear it in your ear and maybe adjust the song. I think like as a working tool, don't hate it.
Because I guess, because usually I'm much harsher on AI, and the only reason I'm not harsh here is because I'm being told up front. My fear as someone who loves art is for corporations and like big media
to kind of get to try a hold
to like
of it.
To try and like just feed me AI media without my
presented
knowledge.
To you on like, you know, it's on your Spotify playlist or whatever, and it's being presented as like this is a real thing when it's like not. Yeah, that I think is. I don't like that either, especially when it's like heavily monetized. Like it sounds like in this question, this is being used. It's like it's a tool,
it's an independent thing,
you know, kind of a brainstorming thing for like a small scale production and some little independent work. But yeah, like I think when it is like thrown at you as like this big thing, like this is going to replace music, don't love that. Anywho,
we're running out of battery.
Yeah, our space card is almost full. This is a very rare occurrence on this podcast. So thank you all so much for the questions. They really were great. I think we nailed this one, really. A lot of good
A lot of good great questions.
Points. I'll try to chop this up into
you
bits.
You wrote some good questions, and Paul, you picked some good ones, though I don't know how you bamboozled me into reading the ones about myself.
Yeah, I know. It's almost like I planned it that way. So, anywho, hopefully you guys enjoyed this episode of The Pot of Greed. Remember, if you don't mind, give it some engagement, likes help, comments help, sharing, subscribing, and of course, hyping the video.
Hype it up.
You can also check out our sponsors for this video, Into the AM. They have some really cool graphics tees.
Oh, yeah, we're wearing those right now,
actually. That we are wearing. You can use our code TEAMXAPS. You'll get 10% off your order. We'll have the link to that in the description. And without further ado, enjoy the rest of your week.
Pass turn.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
Three employees and two work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.